Circuit Court of Appeals, we have one case to be submitted on this docket. We hear United States versus Johnson and United States versus Dinkins. Ms. Wilkes?
May it please the court. My name is Ann Wilkes, and I represent Marty Johnson, defendant appellant in this matter. And there are three issues before the court today with respect to Mr. Johnson and his co-defendant appellant, Ms. Keisha Dinkins. I will be handling the first two issues, which apply with equal force and effect to both Mr. Johnson and Ms. Dinkins. And my colleague, Mr. Carter, will be addressing the last issue, which is unique to Ms. Dinkins. If I make any specific references to the record on appeal, it will be in reference to Mr. Johnson's record 30242. The issues before the court that I'm going to take up today involve restitution. Principally, it is the position of Mr. Johnson that the district court applied the wrong standard of proof in assessing the propriety of the amount of restitution. Secondly, we contend that the PSR without more for the purpose of restitution was improperly utilized when the government failed to satisfy its obligations agreed to in the plea agreement regarding a full investigation into the amount of restitution. And the district court made that decision without providing analysis or making any factual findings on the record, without permitting testimony or argument, and despite inconsistent and vague statements in the PSRs and subsequent documentation that was submitted on the morning of the hearing for sentencing. The parties have extensively briefed these issues, so I'm going to focus on a couple of important points. We agree with the government that there is ample law and jurisprudence that the parties may agree upon a specific amount of restitution in the plea agreement, and that the district court may not need to delve further. This is set out in 18 U.S.C. 3663 and was explained in U.S. versus Arnold. However, the statute itself is permissive, but in any case, there has to be what the parties agreed to. And neither Arnold nor the other cases that the government has cited contemplate the unique language and situation that was in this plea agreement. The government also notes that the plea agreements are contractual in nature and are construed accordingly. This court has repeatedly stated, but most notably in the United States v. Hayes. So the traditional rules of contract apply. Here, Mr. Johnson and Ms. Dinkins' plea agreement contain language that is unique, especially in the situation where there is a number attributed in the restitution agreement. The amount of restitution, quote, will be determined by the court after a complete review of the evidence developed in the investigation of this case by the government and further investigation by the United States Probation Office as contained in the pre-sentence report. I'm sorry?
What relief do you seek?
What we're looking for, Your Honor, is that this matter be remanded to the district court. We request that it be, that the government provide the investigation that they agreed to provide as based in the plea agreement to permit the appellants to review that investigatory information and traverse it if necessary.
And if we don't need to go into all of that, do we? I mean, don't we? Would we, if we were to agree with you, would we just say that under the MVRA, we should remand the cases for the district court to make a determination of the actual loss suffered by HHS? Why wouldn't that be the remedy?
That could be a potential remedy, Your Honor, if we were to have the court determine the actual loss based on the MVRA, that would, I believe, contemplate that the court review the documentation that the government submitted on the time of sentencing. And perhaps there would be a bit of argument about the appropriateness of that documentation if we
but
had
the district court objection. Could have you hash that out there, right?
I'm sorry?
The district court could deal with
of course, yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. You would not have to go into that extensive of detail. The district court would be within their jurisdiction and discretion to handle that matter. So at the time of the plea agreement, the parties didn't know the amount of the actual loss. We agreed to the $3.5 million subject to further investigation. So based on the laws of contract as applied in plea agreements, there's the plea agreement reflects a condition precedent or a suspensive condition.
What is the correct number?
We don't know, Your Honor. We didn't get that far. It's our understanding that the based on the documentation that the government provided, that the that there were some irregularities with the documents that were submitted by the government on the morning of sentencing. We were not able to make any determination at specifically about what some of those numbers meant because we had seen them for the first time when we arrived in the Western District.
Do we know, was there some request for a continuance or something? Remind me of that.
With regard to sentencing?
The first time you saw him was when you got there. Did you say, we need time to look at this?
We requested that, Your Honor. Judge Walters wanted to handle the sentencing that was agreed to in the plea agreement and did not permit anyone to provide any testimony.
Do we know that the 3.5 is wrong because multiplying 1.4 by 2 is only 2.8, and so we know that 3.5 is wrong? Even if you use the spreadsheet that the government had and you extrapolate it from it.
Even if we use the spreadsheet that the government provided, without getting into any issues about the propriety of extrapolation or estimates, the numbers calculated
themselves. So we know that 3.5 is wrong.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
We don't know what the number is, but we know that 3.5 is incorrect.
Do we know it's too much? Or could it possibly be that once you get the real numbers, it's 4?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, based on the documentation that that we reviewed from the government, that it was less than 3.5.
So you do have a lesser number in mind?
We have a lesser number in mind, but without being able to have a better understanding of what the government's documentation does say, I can't tell you what that number is. But just making a very simple mathematical correction without going into their basis and methodology, the number is under 3.5. So at the very least, it would be, I believe, to be 2.8. Here, we're not seeking a piecemeal unraveling like that which was prohibited by this court recently in Brooks. What we're here is seeking to be in compliance with what Brooks said and to avail ourselves of the benefits of the plea agreement.
You agreed to recommend paying $3.5 million in restitution, did you?
That number that we agreed to, Your Honor, was subject to what we contend to be a condition precedent in the plea agreement itself, where we agreed to that $3.5 million, which will be determined after a complete review of the evidence developed in an investigation of this case by the government. So that language is not meaningless, it's important. That language was not included in many of the cases that were cited by the government, including the Williams case. The Williams case is appropriate for the position that when there's an agreed upon amount of restitution, that number governs, and there's been a waiver. But in this case, we have this condition precedent or substantive condition that's in this language that wasn't in the language in Williams.
Did you file a letter about Brooks, the case Brooks?
We did not file a letter on Brooks. The government filed a letter on Brooks.
Right. Didn't file a response?
We did not respond.
Okay. Do you have a response?
Yeah, the response is that the Brooks opinion, it makes, based on the facts in Brooks, is appropriate, and there should not be a piecemeal unraveling of the plea agreement that was agreed to. What we're saying here is that part of what we agreed to was to the $3.5 million subject to this further investigation and information, and that's what we didn't receive.
So read the key language again from the agreement.
Sure. Restitution in this case may not be limited to the amounts or victims referred to in the specific charges to which the defendant has pled guilty and will be determined by the court after a complete review of the evidence developed in the investigation of this case by the government and further investigation by the United States Probation Office as contained in the pre-sentence report. And that is record on appeal 1572 and 73.
What about the
where does it say the 3.5 million?
3.5 million is in paragraph, I believe, 3. I can tell you. That's in paragraph 6, and I believe that the 3.5 is in paragraph 3. And section E, paragraph 3, both, and it's on that same page, 1572,
1573. All right, and so read us, in context, the 3.5. What does the agreement say?
So that's in paragraph 6, and then we go into E, non-binding restitution recommendations. The government and Marty Johnson recommend that Marty Johnson be assessed restitution of $3.5 million to be made payable immediately to the victim, United States government. The government and Marty Johnson acknowledge that the loss and restitution recommendations from the parties are not binding and on the court, and that the loss and restitution shall be determined by the court. That read in conjunction with the paragraph 6 that I previously addressed suggests to appellants that it is A. May I finish my sentence?
Sure.
I suggest that there's a condition precedent. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, Ms. Wood. And you save time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Carter?
May it please the court. My name is Mark Carter. I am here. Mr. McMichael was hospitalized, unable to appear today, and I am standing in on his behalf. I represent Ms. Keisha Dinkins, defendant and appellant below. I adopt Ms. Wilkes' argument made on behalf of Ms. Dinkins, and Ms. Wilkes' argument made on behalf of Marty Johnson regarding the district court's error in the restitution calculation amount for the reasons assigned to her in her argument. In regards to my client, Ms. Dinkins, I am urging the court to remand this matter to the district court for sentencing with direction for the district court to consider the individual factors from the record to determine what portion of the $3.5 million loss should apply to her individually for sentencing purposes. Excuse me, our position is the district court erred by attributing the entire amount of the $3.5 million loss to Ms. Dinkins for sentencing purposes.
Now you keep saying the $3.5 million loss. You're not saying that's the right amount.
No, ma'am, I'm not.
You're just using what the amount that was awarded.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But you didn't object to the $3.5 million calculation itself.
Yes, Your Honor, we do. I adopted Ms. Wilkes' argument from earlier.
At the time?
At the time, there was an objection as well. So the pre-sentencing investigation report attributed all loss caused by the fraud activities attributed to Ms. Dinkins. We timely filed objection to the PSR on February 10, 2022. And that is in 30.302.49.2033 of the record. Thereafter, March 8, 2022, probation filed a revised PSR with an addendum. And the Dinkins pre-sentencing memorandum, we had argued that because Dinkins had a limited role at the positive change, and that she received none of the profit or other benefit save her regular salary of $3,600 a month, which she began receiving in the second year, that she received no benefit through the fraud activities and of the Marty Johnson or positive change, that it was inequitable to attribute the entire loss amount to her activities and thereby greatly increase the statutory guidelines. Our position is that restitution, in addition to receiving a jail sentence and fines, the criminal defendant may be ordered to pay restitution. We understand that is the definition. Restitution is distinguishable from fines because fines are punitive, while restitution is compensatory to the victims.
Do you know where, I know you're substituting in, but do you know where she ever said this should be for the company and I should have less lot culpability in the district court?
Yes, Your Honor, I think I can point to that, given 1 second.
I mean, I don't want to take all your time if you don't.
No, you're fine. So, I'm trying to find that. Okay, when we, it looks like in the record, we laid out the her past experience as a pharmacist at 1368. No, that's not what you're exactly asking. It was the salary, and she was responsible for tax matters and personnel matters. She had no role in the clinical transportation, did not prepare bills sent to the various providers, and did not share in any of the profits, and that was at 1368 as well.
Thank you.
Yes. In short, given that Dinkins was not aware of or involved in supervising clinical activities, did not prepare or send bills to managed care providers, and did not receive any of the fraudulent obtained funds or profits, it is inappropriate to attribute the entire loss to her without considering the factors. Now, given that the district court were to go back and consider the various factors, then of course it would be within the purview of the court to set what it finds. We're just saying there's nothing in the record that shows the court took such action to balance and determine individually what responsibility for sentencing, what level of loss, i.e. the dollar amount, that Ms. Dinkins should, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carter. We appreciate your being able to fill in. That's helpful to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Phillips?
May it please the court, Forrest Phillips for the United States. This court should affirm the district court's sentence in this case. I want to start with the restitution issue since it's been what's been discussed the most. First, this court should affirm the restitution judgment in this case because the defendants agreed to it as part of their plea agreements. 3663A expressly contemplates agreement as a basis for imposing a restitution judgment. And I want to discuss the idea that there is some sort of conditioned precedent here with that language in the plea agreement about how there'll be an investigation. That language does have a purpose in the plea agreements to notify the parties that this is not a C1C plea. That is under Rule 11 colloquies. There's a version of a guilty plea where the district court must accept the number in a plea agreement, must accept a recommended sentence, a recommended restitution amount. And this language merely informs all the parties, specifically the defendants, that that is not a requirement here. The district court will get the evidence. The district court may not agree with the $3.5 million number. Now, it did here. And there's nothing in this case that suggests that all the district court did not get all of the evidence pursuant to the plea agreement recommending or providing discovery to the district court. There is nothing in this plea agreement that obligates the district court to hold a contested evidentiary hearing in the face of a recommendation by the parties as to a loss amount.
What meaning do we give to the language about how there be an amount to be determined through investigation? I guess brother by the probation office.
Again, Your Honor, that language merely informs the parties that this is not a C plea, that this is not a plea the district court must accept. It still has the ability to consider all the evidence in this case. But again, Your Honor, as far as the defendant's understanding of this plea agreement, that recommendation, when they do their plea colloquies and the district court asks them, now you've agreed to pay $3.5 million in restitution, correct? You've agreed to do your best to pay $3.5 million in restitution, correct? They're not saying, well, yes, but only after that number has been calculated pursuant to a contested evidentiary hearing. This case is almost like a defendant saying, I agree to plead guilty after my trial and the jury finds me such. Or a counsel saying, I agree to the admissibility of a piece of evidence after you've resolved my objections and the government's established a foundation. That agreement has no value under the defendant's view, and what we heard today still does not articulate the value of the recommendation in this case. What does it mean if the district court is required to hold a contested evidentiary hearing in the face of that number? And that recommendation has to mean, at a minimum, that the loss amount in this case was greater than $3.5 million. Otherwise, you have the defendants recommending an amount of restitution that is below the actual loss amount.
Do you still take the position that the VWPA applies rather than the MVRA, and why?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. So the 3553, the VMRA versus 3553A, or 63, excuse me, all that the Mandatory Restitution Act does is say these are the offenses that there must be restitution in. It does not say that there can be no agreement under the MVRA as to the restitution amount. And I want to direct this court, you're not going to find this case in the briefing, but this has really not been a dispute. The defendants conceded on their initial argument that the MVRA statutes still allow for an agreement as to restitution. This is Marunda. It is 731 Federal Appendix 281. There is a brief discussion.
You're citing some case that's not in your brief on this point?
Just to explain that the NVRA still allows for an agreement of restitution amount, Your Honor. That's not been in dispute this entire case, but I do want to let the court know that this court has discussed the interplay between the two and has no problem with allowing an agreement to restitution amount under the NVRA.
I still don't understand. Johnson pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud, which is clearly covered by the MVRA, and it says it shall apply in all sentencing proceedings for conviction of or plea agreements relating to or charges for any offense that's included in any offense committed by fraud or deceit. I don't understand why it doesn't apply, because the MVRA rather than the VWPA, because the VWPA specifically accepts out other than an offense described in 3663AC, and this qualifies.
Yes, Your Honor. That exception comes within a discussion of how the district court may order restitution in every case except these specific ones, where if you go to that statute, it says must. That's the only reason that's in there, is it's making sure that courts understand that there must be restitution under mandatory.
Does it matter to you whether we say it's MVRA or VW?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor, because you are allowed to agree to a restitution amount under either statute.
So.
Yeah. So we'll continue on. The recommendation in this case, when it is accepted by the district court and the PSRs start to come out, and this is telling as to what the defendant's understanding of this recommendation was in the district court, there is no objection when the PSR comes out as to it lacking an investigation or any explanation as to how that number was arrived at. When Ms. Dinkins files her objections to the PSR, it is solely on this argument that she shouldn't be responsible for the entire loss amount. It is only via a supplemental sentencing memo a few days before sentencing that this issue is first presented to the district court, that maybe the defendants don't think they should have to pay $3.5 million in restitution. So, and after the sentencing hearing is held, there is no objection at that hearing saying that no hearing was provided, no contested evidentiary proceeding took place, and the district court is left with the impression that it's resolved whatever issue has formed in this case. There's simply no objection to the amount used for restitution being the amount the defendants recommended.
I don't understand where the amount actually, why it's a good amount. Can you help with that?
The first reason would be that the defendants agreed that this is a provable actual loss
amount. That's one aside. Why would it be the correct amount?
I think that if you look at the record in this case, the government states in response to Ms. Dinkins' pre-sentencing memorandum that $3.5 million number was arrived at through an extremely conservative estimate, giving them absolutely every benefit of the doubt. when a contested evidentiary proceeding would likely result in a much higher number. And the only evidence we have in the record as to a loss amount in this case is, in fact, a higher number. And that spreadsheet is by no means necessary for this court to affirm the district court's judgment, but it is a number higher than $3.5 million, and it's a document that was not objected to in the district court. And we are told that the reason for that is they did not have time to review it. There is no indication.
It wasn't even in the record at the time of the sentencing hearing, was it?
It was filed into the record at the beginning of the sentencing hearing. I think it's plain the district court had some discussion about it before the sentencing took place. But he said, I want you to file that in your record. Correct, Your Honor. It was contemplated in the opening words of the sentencing hearing. And the district court said, I want you to file that spreadsheet in the record.
And so then they weren't given an opportunity to add evidence into the record after the sentencing hearing to try to contradict the spreadsheet, were they?
Your Honor, I think it's plain in this case that that $3.5 million number, at no point did the defendants attempt to offer any indication of why that number should be reduced. This goes to burden shifting. This is beyond simple agreement to the amount. The defendants never offered any indication of why that number should be lower than $3.5 million.
Well, what about the fact that it's a two-year figure of 1.4 and it shouldn't be multiplied by 3 years because the scheme didn't last 6 years? The PSR says the scheme only lasted 4 years. And so it's overstating the length of the scheme in order to use this. The spreadsheet is off when it gets to six, when it gets to 3.5.
Again, these spreadsheet issues, and the defense acknowledged having received this document prior to the sentencing, whether it's in the record during the sentencing is a different matter. These spreadsheet issues are something that should have been objected to in the district court.
Is that wrong, though?
Well, Your Honor,
but it's really only 4 years and this, if you use the amount in the spreadsheet, it would say it lasted 6 years.
Your Honor, these are things.
Is that correct or not? Is the math wrong?
The record does not discuss where this multiplier came from.
Where did the multiplier come from?
The time to debate that would have been when the spreadsheet was provided in the district court and an objection either for a continuance or an objection based on this issue that is now developed on appeal. That did not happen.
Well, they said they did ask for a continuance.
The record does not reflect a request for continuance. I think the discussion there was that the district court judge, prior to going on the record, said, we're going forward with the amount you recommended in your plea agreement. What's going on here?
Well, the act, under the MVRA, it really has to be the actual amount of loss. Can you tell us from this record how, other than the fact that you think that they agreed is the reason, can you get us to 3.5 using the data that's in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. I can provide an evidentiary basis to
what
show
is that?
That the loss amount is at least $3.5 million.
What is that?
So there are no evidentiary, there's no concern about that. So the agreement, regardless of whether it is binding as a plea agreement factor, also has evidentiary weight. When these defendants recommend a $3.5 million loss amount, they are doing so with the benefit of having seen, remember, this pled on the morning of trial. They've had years to review the discovery in this case and feel comfortable with the recommendation to that amount. Otherwise,
that's not, where is the evidentiary record that would support these numbers? Can you get us to these numbers using things in the record such that would support the district court's determination?
Yes, Your Honor. So let's set aside the evidentiary value of the recommendation and the fact that the defendants intended
yes.
that recommendation with the benefit of years worth of discovery review. Let's set aside this spreadsheet. And
well,
then
you
let's
told me we have to set the spreadsheet apart because it doesn't work. I mean, the spreadsheet doesn't tell us where they got the multiplier.
Yes, but and let's set aside the fact that the time to have debated anything with that spreadsheet would have been in the district court when it's provided.
Okay, well, can you get us there to this number in a pure way that the court could be comfortable
yes.
with
yes.
this number?
So there are some undisputed numbers in this case. One is the $8 million plus amount that Medicaid paid to Positive Change over the course of this scheme.
But we don't assume that all of that is fraudulent. There are actually some aren't there some actual services that were rendered?
Your Honor, the only indication that there are services rendered is a passing comment in a response to a sentencing memo that when the government says the government took a very conservative estimate here because some services were provided to patients. In that respect, this case is no different than this court's decision in Sharma when the burden shifted to the defendants to show a offset from the amount that Medicare had paid, and the defendants in that case attempted to say, well, wait a minute, there are some services provided to patients in this case, and it does not follow from that fact that, because Medicaid is the victim in this case, the fact that patients received some service or benefit says nothing about whether Medicare would have paid for that benefit, Medicaid would have paid for that benefit absent the fraud. And it's wrong that the...
So you think $8 million is a legitimate amount of the loss in this case, to answer my original question?
I think this comes together with the $3.5 million number, because what happened here was after years of discovery and protracted negotiations, the government gave the defendants the benefit of an offset here, all the way down to $3.5 million, so they didn't have to litigate the very issues that we are litigating right now.
Well, you know, the government has the burden to prove by preponderance of the evidence the amount of loss, and every dollar must be supported by record evidence.
So that every dollar must be supported by record evidence phrase, you see that whenever there is a discussion or concern that actual loss amount might be exceeded, that restitution amount might exceed actual loss amount. That's just a way of saying that restitution judgment cannot exceed actual loss. In this case, and then, you know, you have the Supreme Court's decision in Paroline that makes that clear. There is no precise mathematical formula to restitution. There is no specific type of evidence that has to be admitted to establish a restitution number. And the restitution preponderance of the evidence standard is no different than the standard for guidelines loss amount, with this one caveat that it cannot exceed actual loss.
Okay, so $8 million, where do we get that?
That is the undisputed amount that Medicaid, paid to this clinic. And that is coupled with unrebutted evidence laid out in the PSR.
And the $8 million is in the PSR?
Correct. The amount paid to this entity over the course of the scheme. They billed for something over 12, they were paid around $7.88 million. The $3.5 million number in this case, a product of negotiation and a recommendation, merely prevented the defendants from having to do what they would have had to do at a sentencing, which is offer evidence suggesting they deserve an offset from that number. Remember, the evidence in this case, the facts that are not disputed in the PSR, are that this was a long-running scheme where the allegations and the conduct is not billing for a service, overbilling for a service that was actually provided to a patient. The conduct in this case, was fabricating patients from whole cloth, fabricating billing statements from whole cloth, buying Medicaid enrollment information from people off the street and billing in their names when they've never set foot in the clinic. When the government says some services were provided in that response to a PSR memorandum, it doesn't follow from that Medicaid would have paid for these services. The defendants should have established that, and just like the defendants in Sharma, a case where there was no recommendation for the district court to rely on, failed to do so, the defendants have failed to do so here. Given this recommendation, if it means anything, it left a window for the defendants to try to suggest why this number should be lower. Imagine the government coming in with that $3.5 million number and saying, we actually want a higher amount of restitution in this case. It's nonsensical. And I want to emphasize again, the defendants still have not explained what value this $3.5 million restitution recommendation would have under their reading of the plea agreement.
You need to be sure and save some time to discuss the arguments on behalf of Ms. Dinkins.
Yes, the arguments Ms. Dinkins are simply that there was a clear evidentiary basis for the district court to decide that Ms. Dinkins either knew or reasonably should have known the complete loss amount in this case. Again, her factual stipulation admits to being aware that the Positive Change Clinic was billing for patients fraudulently that had not visited the clinic, and that Ms. Dinkins herself personally participated in some of these record fabrication sessions. Now, we have a little bit of discussion in this case about the nature of these sessions at the motion to suppress, and it's an assembly line process where employees at the clinic and individuals they brought into the clinic spend hours making records out of whole cloth to fool auditors at the various agencies, either Medicaid or private insurers. So the district court clearly had a basis to find by preponderance of the evidence that Ms. Dinkins either knew or reasonably should have known the full extent of the loss in this case.
So both defendants then are responsible for the entire amount?
Correct. Correct. It's not about how much you benefited from the fraud. It's about whether the scope of the fraud was known to you or reasonably could have been known to you under the guidelines.
Well, she says that it wasn't known to her because she wasn't there and she was only working part-time and she wasn't supervising all these activities that were fraudulent.
So, you know, we're talking about a clear error finding by preponderance of the evidence here, and we're removing the fact that Ms. Dinkins expressly recommended $3.5 million as an appropriate loss amount in her plea agreement. The district court had a basis for that finding by preponderance of the evidence from the factual basis in this case. She acknowledges that she knows that Mr. Johnson and Positive Change are billing for patients that did not visit the clinic, fabricating patient records, and that she personally supervised in the fabrication of these records. Before my time runs out, I do want to say that if this case is remanded to the district court, the defendants have suggested district court should be barred from taking new evidence in this case, or even that the amount of restitution is unascertainable in this case, and thus a $0 judgment should be entered. Any potential remand in this case should make clear that the district court has the authority to consider restitution anew and without being cabined by any particular prior proceeding.
I thought I heard Ms. Wilkes tell us that the remand should be for further investigation. Maybe I heard her wrong. She can clarify that.
The brief said one thing. I think there's been some clarification today, but I just want to request that any hypothetical remand allow the district court to reach any number that makes sense, not $0, which is what she suggested would be appropriate in her initial brief.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
Ms. Wilkes for rebuttal.
As Justice Elrod noted appropriately, there is no harmless error in restitution determinations, and the concept that every dollar must be accounted for, I don't want to suggest to this court that I would like the district court to account or the government to account for every dollar. The purpose of that language is that the evidence needs to be supported with a sufficient indicia of reliability. Here, there is no basis provided in the PSR that reflects where that number came from. And when we look at the spreadsheet that was submitted on the record, that's wrong on its face.
Are you relying on Sharma, our decision?
I'm relying on that Sharma decision.
What do you do with the full language that you did? Let me read the balance you didn't read.
Sure.
Holding the district court erred in relying on a flawed PSR while calculating a restitution order, fine so far, where the parties did not agree on a specific restitution amount in their plea agreement. And here we have plain agreements to the amount in the plea bargain.
That's correct, and that is a distinction, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct about that. The distinction, while there was an agreement, and while there was no agreement in Sharma, in this case we have that language, again, that suggests that there should be a further investigation based on the $3.5 million.
Yeah, looking, that occurred before the plea agreements.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then you went into plea bargaining, and you bargained it out, and quite plainly, as I read the colloquy, the district court accepted those recommendations of those amounts. So if we send it back, then The plea bargain is you going to undo the plea bargaining?
No, Your Honor, we have no intention of undoing the plea bargaining.
Then you have to give us some basis for escaping the plea bargain rather than the other way around.
Sure, the basis for escaping the plea bargain is that when Mr. Johnson and Ms. Dinkins signed the plea agreement, they were under the impression that there would be some investigation to determine whether that $3.5 million was appropriate. That paragraph 6 that I was referring to during my original argument, the government notes that it was to notify the parties that this was not a C1C plea agreement.
Well, if you were going to open it up again, it may not be $8.5 million. The government may well go back to the $16 to $20 million that you're talking about.
That's possible, Your Honor. That's correct. But it is the position of the plaintiffs that there was an agreement that was made. There was a benefit that should have been inured by the defendants, which was that there be an investigation to determine the amount of restitution by the government and by the probation office.
Let your attention remind you of what the district court said to her, to the defendant that may have the more difficulty in making that probation. So you just do the best you can. I recognize you may not be able to pay over that, do the best you can, but impose it, because that was the agreement. In other words, the difficulty I'm having with your argument is that you do not deal with the plea with the plea bargaining, with the actual plea agreements that were made. In other words, whatever the amount was, that all occurred before that you stood up in open court and took a plea of guilty.
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. The way that this case was handled in terms of timing created a situation where that $3.5 million was placed in the plea agreement, and it was the plaintiff.
Do you dispute that it's overall? How much? What was the figure in your mind that the government paid these people? This whole thing was a fraud, and he's giving you a number of like $15, $20 million. What's your number?
At the very least, Your Honor, it's 2.8.
I'm sorry?
At the very most, Your Honor, it's $2.8 million based on the spreadsheet. $2.8 million based on the spreadsheet that was provided by the government.
You say that the total, the fraud number was only $2.8 million?
Yes, Your Honor.
How long was this in operation? What was the span charged?
3 years, Your Honor. That is the conclusion of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Wilkes. Mr. Carter for rebuttal.
In regards to the portion applicable to Ms. Dinkins for the loss and the determination of sentencing guidelines, Mr. Phillips did a great job of saying, you know, we have this agreement, and I'm going to stand and rely on the arguments made in regard to the agreement. What I was trying to bring out with a little bit of a distinction was that the two points that he made was a basis from the agreement. We've dealt with that. The second was factual things that were actually done, according to the government. My position is none of that was considered or written in what those considerations were as to how it individually applied to Ms. Dinkins by the district court. Had those been clearly written out and said, these are the things that I'm looking at, here's the positive, here's the negative, and this is the amount that we're putting, beyond just the fact that there was this purported agreement for the $3.5 million, then I think it would be considered. It would have been considered, and that's the proper way, in my humble opinion, that the court should go about it. They should look at the mitigating and other factors and make its determination, and that was not done on the record, and I would ask that the court be directed to look at Ms. Dinkins' limited role, the fact that she received no money, and other factors in making that determination. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carter. Your case is under submission, and the court is adjourned.